When you watch a magician perform a quick change act, there's always this moment of like pure illusion. You know, a velvet cloth drops and the assistant is suddenly in a totally different outfit.
Right, the outward appearance is radically transformed, but I mean, obviously, it's the exact same person underneath.
Exactly. And welcome to the deep dive. For you listening today, we are actually stepping right into that kind of illusion, but one engineered by lawmakers, not magicians. We're looking at the legal succession to the South African Transport Services Act of 1989.
Yeah, we're basically going to unpack how a government takes this massive state-run transport network and legally rebrands it as a corporate entity. And, well, we'll get into the incredibly gritty, micromanaged reality of running that network.
Which is hidden deep inside the fine print, right?
Right.
So the primary function of this 1989 text is taking the entire commercial enterprise of SAS, the South African Transport Services, and transferring it into a new public company and a rail commuter corporation. All the assets, liabilities, and, you know, employees slide over to the new entity. But the state remains the sole 100% shareholder. It's kind of like a teenager who proudly announces they're moving out into their own private apartment,
Oh, I like this analogy.
but their parents actually own the building, hold the lease, and pay the rent.
Yeah, that's spot on. And that separation serves a very specific legal purpose. By establishing this company, the state is restructuring liability to create, well, a legal buffer.
Right.
Practically, this means if a train derails or a contractor gets injured, the public sues this new corporate entity, not the Minister of Transport directly. So the state gets a liability shield while retaining absolute control.
And what's wild is that legal shield extends right down to the physical dirt and gravel of the railways. I was reading Schedule One, the operating provisions, and the level of everyday micromanagement is just bizarre.
Oh, absolutely.
I actually found an entire section dictating exactly what a farmer has to do if one of these corporate trains hits their cow out in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, the 72-hour reporting rule. A farmer has to report the incident within 3 days. But more importantly, they are legally obligated to physically preserve the livestock carcass for that entire time.
Wait, really? Just keep a dead cow lying around?
Yeah, for 3 full days. Or until an inspector arrives to ascertain its value.
Which seems like a huge, strangely specific burden to place on some random farmer. I mean, why?
Think about it mechanically, though. Forcing the physical preservation of the carcass prevents fraudulent claims. A farmer can't just, drag an old sick cow that died of natural causes onto the tracks and claim it was their prize-winning breeding bull.
Oh, wow. Okay, that makes sense.
Right. The evidence has to be verified by the company's inspector. And speaking of limiting liability, notice the rule regarding level crossings at night.
Oh, yeah. The trains have zero legal obligation to sound a warning whistle between 23AJ1 and 04S59.
Exactly.
It's essentially a blanket exemption from noise regulations and negligence claims during those hours.
Right. They are aggressively engineering a highly protective operational environment for this new entity.
So they've built this meticulous legal shield to protect the company from everyday accidents and lawsuits. But how strong is that shield when the threat to their finances isn't a wandering cow, but the government itself?
Section 15.
Right. Section 15 of the Act says the state can force this company to construct and operate completely unprofitable services, like remote railway lines or harbors. If they are a corporate entity now, it seems contradictory that they can't just refuse a guaranteed financial loss.
Well, you've hit on the exact paradox of this act. They cannot say no to the state. But the mechanism for handling that loss is what's really interesting. The state is legally required to cover all the costs of those forced unprofitable routes out of its own revenue fund.
So the taxpayer's just subsidizing the loss anyway.
Not just subsidizing the loss, the act dictates the state must also guarantee the company a, quote, reasonable profit on those specific operations.
Wait, so the state forces the service, pays the operating costs, and artificially pads the corporate revenue.
Exactly. And to further ensure uninterrupted operations, the minister also retains the ultimate power to prohibit strikes and lockouts by the workers.
Wow. The next time you pay a fare to a supposedly private national rail or energy company, remember this 1989 blueprint. It is an incredibly clever piece of legal engineering.
It really is. It shows how governments can privatize an entity on paper while maintaining total invisible control. It creates the appearance of free market efficiency, but the safety nets are entirely funded by the state.
Which leaves a pretty massive open question for you to mull over. If the state holds all the shares, artificially guarantees the profits using public funds, and bans the workers from striking, when these quasi-private shell companies take on massive international debt to fund their expansion, who is really on the hook when the bill comes due? Think about that for a while.